An old man was standing about 10 strides away. He was making no move forward, was holding no weapon. He was just standing, looking at her with a benign smile. She let the arrow fly. Now, Pharaoh was about as deadly with a bow as it's possible to be. The 10 dead soldiers could have testified to that, if they'd been able. 6 of them had her arrows sticking out of them, and in that fight she hadn't missed once. She couldn't remember missing at close range, however quickly the shot had been taken, and she'd killed men 10 times further away than this smiling old bastard was now. But this time, she missed. The arrow seemed to curve in the air. A bad feather, maybe, but it still didn't seem quite right. The old man didn't flinch, not even a hair. He simply stood, smiling, exactly where he'd always stood, and the arrow missed him by a few inches and disappeared off down the hillside. And that gave everyone time to consider the situation. He was a strange one, this old man. Very dark-skinned, black as coal, which meant he was from the far south, across the wide and shelterless desert. That's a journey not lightly taken, and Pharaoh had rarely seen such people. Tall and thin, with long, sinewy arms and a simple robe wrapped round him. There were strange bangles round his wrists, stacked up so they covered half his forearms, glittering dark and light in the savage sun. His hair was a mass of grey ropes about his face, some hanging down as low as his waist, and there was a grey stubble on his lean, pointed jaw. He had a big water skin wrapped around his chest and a bunch of leather bags hanging from a belt around his waist. Nothing else. No weapon. That was the strangest thing of all, for a man out here in the Badlands. No one came to this godforsaken place except those who were running, and those sent to hunt them. In either case, they should be well armed. He was no soldier of Gurkle. He was no scum come looking for the money on her head. He was no bandit, no escaped slave. What was he then? And why was he here? He must have come for her. He could be one of them. An eater. Who else would wander the Badlands without a weapon? She hadn't realized they wanted her that badly. He stood there motionless, the old man, smiling at her. She reached slowly for another arrow, and his eyes followed her without any worry.
"That really isn't necessary," he said in a slow, deep voice.
She knocked the arrow to her bow. The old man didn't move. She shrugged her shoulders and took her time aiming. The old man smiled on, not a care in the world. She let the arrow fly. It missed him by a few inches again, this time on the other side, and shot off down the hillside. Once was a possibility, she had to admit that, but twice was wrong. If Pharaoh knew one thing, and one thing only, she knew how to kill. The old fool should have been stuck through and bleeding out his last into the stony soil. Now, simply by standing still and smiling, he seemed to be saying, "You know less than you think. I know more." That was very galling.
"Who are you, you old bastard?"
"They call me Yolwe."
"Old bastard will do for you."
She tossed her bow down on the ground, let her arms drop to her sides so that her right hand was hidden from him by her body. She twisted her wrist, and the curved knife dropped out of her sleeve and into her waiting palm. There are many ways to kill a man, and if one way fails, you must try another. Pharaoh had never been one to give up at the first stumble. Yulwe began to move slowly towards her, his bare feet padding on the rocks, bangles jingling softly together. That was very strange, now she thought about it. If he made a noise every time he moved, how had he managed to sneak up on her?
"What do you want?"
"I want to help you."
He came forward until he was just over an arm's length away, then he stopped and stood, grinning at her. Now Pharaoh was fast as a snake with a knife and twice as deadly, as the last of those soldiers could have testified, had he been able. The blade was a shining blur in the air, swung with all her strength and all her fury behind it, If he had been standing where she thought he was, his head would have been hanging off. Only he wasn't. He was standing about a stride to the left. She threw herself at him with a fighting scream, ramming the glittering point of the knife into his heart. But she stabbed only air. He was back where he had been before, motionless and smiling all the while. Very strange. She padded round him, cautious, sandaled feet scuffing in the dust, left hand circling in the air in front of her, right hand gripped tight round the handle of the knife. She had to be careful. There was magic here.
There is no need to get angry. I am here to help.
Fuck your help,
she hissed back at him.
But you need it, and badly. They are coming for you, Pharaoh. There are soldiers in the hills, many soldiers.
I'll outrun them.
There are too many. You cannot outrun them all.
She glanced round at the punctured bodies.
Then I'll give them to the vultures.
Not this time. They are not alone. They have help.
On the word help, his deep voice dropped even lower. Pharaoh frowned.
Priests?
Yes, and more besides.
His eyes went very wide.
An eater, he whispered. They mean to take you alive. The Emperor wants to make an example of you. He has it in mind to put you on display.
She snorted.
Fuck the Emperor!
I heard you already did.
She growled and raised the knife again, but it was not a knife. There was a hissing snake in her hand, a deadly snake with its mouth open to bite.
Ah!
She threw it on the ground, stamped her foot down on its head, but she stamped on her knife instead. The blade snapped with a sharp crack.
They will catch you, said the old man. They will catch you, and they will break your legs with hammers in the city square, so you can never run again. Then they will parade you through the streets of Shafa, naked, sitting backwards on an ass, with your hair shaved off, while the people line the streets and shout insults at you.
She frowned at him, but Yulwe did not stop.
They will starve you to death in a cage before the palace, cooking in the hot sun, while the good people of Gurkhal taunt you and spit on you and throw dung at you through the bars. Perhaps they will give you piss to drink, if you are lucky. When you finally die, they will let you rot, and the flies will eat you bit by bit, and all the other slaves will see what freedom looks like and decide they are better off as they are.
Pharaoh was bored with this. Let them come, and the eater, too. She wouldn't die in a cage. She would cut her own throat if it came to that. She turned her back on him with a scowl and snatched up the shovel, started digging away furiously at the last grave. Soon it was deep enough. Deep enough for the scum who'd be rotting in it. She turned around. Yulwe was kneeling down by the dying soldier, giving him water from the skin round his chest.
Fuck!
She shouted, striding over, her fingers locked around the handle of the shovel. The old man got to his feet as she came close.
Mercy,
croaked the soldier, stretching out his hand.
I'll give you mercy.
The edge of the shovel bit deep into the soldier's skull. The body twitched briefly, then was still. She turned to the old man with a look of triumph. He stared back sadly. There was something in his eyes. Pity, maybe?
What do you want, Pharaoh Mal'jin?
What?
Why did you do that?
Yulwe pointed down at the dead man. What do you want?
Vengeance!
She spat out the word.
On all of them? On the whole nation of Gurkul? Every man, woman, and child?
All of them!
The old man looked round the corpses.
Then you must be very happy with today's work.
She forced a smile onto her face.
Yes.
But she wasn't very happy. She couldn't remember what it felt like. The smile seemed strange, unfamiliar, all lopsided.
And is vengeance all you think of? Every minute of every day, your only desire?
Yes.
Hurting them? Killing them? Ending them?
Yes.
You want nothing for yourself?
She paused.
What?
For yourself. What do you want?
She stared at the old man suspiciously, but no reply came to her. Yulwe shook his head sadly.
It seems to me, Pharaoh Mal'jin, that you are as much a slave as you ever were, or ever could be.
He sat down, cross-legged, on a rock. She stared at him for a moment, confused. Then the anger bubbled up again, hot and reassuring.
If you came to help me, you can help me bury them.
She pointed over at the three bloody corpses lined up next to the graves.
Oh, no. That is your work.
She turned away from the old man, cursing under her breath, and moved over to her one-time companions. She took Shebed's corpse under the arms and hauled him over to the first grave, his heels making two little grooves in the dust. When she made it to the hole, she rolled him in. Alugai was next. A stream of dry soil ran over him as he came to rest in the bottom of his grave. She turned to Nassar's carcass. He had been killed by a sword cut across the face. Pharaoh thought it was something of an improvement to his looks.
That one looks a good sort, said Yulwe.
Nassar?
She laughed without amusement.
A raper, a thief, a coward?
She hawked up some phlegm and spat into his dead face. It splattered softly against his forehead.
Much the worst of the three.
She looked down at the graves.
But they were all of them shit.
Nice company you keep.
The hunted don't have the luxury of choosing their companions.
She stared at Nassar's bloody face.
You take what's offered.
If you dislike them so much, why don't you leave them for the vultures, like you have these others?
Yulwe swept his arm over the broken soldiers on the ground.
You bury your own.
She kicked Nassar into the hole. He rolled forward, arms flopping, and dropped into the grave face down.
That's the way it's always been.
She grabbed hold of the shovel and started to heap the stony earth onto his back. She worked in silence, the sweat building up on her face, then dripping off onto the ground. Yulwe watched her as the holes filled up. Three more piles of dirt in the wasteland. She threw the shovel away, and it bounced off one of the corpses and clattered among the stones. A small cloud of black flies buzzed angrily off the body, then returned. Pharaoh picked up her bow and arrows and slung them over her shoulder. She took the water skin, checked its weight carefully, then shouldered that also. Then she picked over the bodies of the soldiers. One of them, he looked like the leader, had a fine curved sword. He hadn't even managed to draw it before her arrow had caught him in the throat. Pharaoh drew it now, and she tested it with a couple of sweeps through the air. It was very good, well balanced, the long blade glittering deadly sharp, bright metal on the hilt catching the sun. He had a knife as well that matched it. She took the weapons and stuck them through her belt. She picked over the other bodies, but there wasn't much to take. She cut her arrows from the corpses where she could. She found some coins and tossed them away. They would only weigh her down, and what would she buy out here in the Badlands? Dirt? That was all there was, and it was free. They had a few scraps of food with them, but not enough even for another day. That meant there must be others, probably lots of them, and not far away. Yulwe was telling the truth, but it made no difference to her. She turned and started to walk southward, down off the hill and towards the great desert, leaving the old man behind.
That's the wrong way, he said.
She stopped, squinting at him in the bright sun.
Aren't the soldiers coming?
Yulwe's eyes sparkled.
There are many ways of staying unnoticed, even out here in the Badlands.
She looked to the north, out over the featureless plain below, out towards Gurkul. There wasn't a hill or a tree or scarcely a bush for miles, nowhere to hide.
Unnoticed, even by an eater?
The old man laughed. especially by those arrogant swine. They're not half as clever as they think they are. How do you think I got here? I came through them, between them, around them. I go where I please, and I take who I please with me."
She shaded her eyes with her hand and squinted southward. The desert stretched away into the far distance and beyond. Pharaoh could survive here in the wilderness, just about, but out there in that crucible of changing sands and merciless heat. The old man seemed to read her thoughts.
"There are always the endless sands. I have crossed them before. It can be done, but not by you."
He was right, damn him. Pharaoh was lean and tough as a bowstring, but that just meant she would walk in circles a little longer before pitching on her face. The desert was preferable to the cage before the palace as a place to die, but not by much. She wanted to stay alive. There were still things to do. The old man sat there, cross-legged, smiling. What was he? Pharaoh trusted no one, but if he meant to deliver her to the emperor, he could have knocked her on the head while she was digging, instead of announcing his arrival. He had magic, she had seen that for herself, and some chance was better than none. But what would he want in return? The world had never given Pharaoh anything for free, and she didn't expect it to begin now. She narrowed her eyes.
"What do you want from me, Yulwe?"
The old man laughed. That laugh was becoming very annoying.
"Let us just say that I will have done you a favor. Later on, you can do me one in return."
That answer was horribly thin on the details, but when your life's on the table, you have to take whatever's offered. She hated to place herself in the power of another, but it seemed she had no choice. Not if she wanted to live out the week, that is.
"What do we do?"
"We must wait for nightfall."
Yulwe glanced at the twisted bodies scattered about the ground and wrinkled his nose.
"But perhaps not here."
Pharaoh shrugged and sat herself down on the middle grave.
"Here will do," she said. "I've a mind to watch the vultures eat."
Overhead, the clear night sky was scattered with bright stars, and the air had turned cool, cold even. Down on the dark and dusty plain below, fires were burning, a curved line of fires that seemed to hem them in against the edge of the desert. She, Yulwe, the 10 corpses, and the 3 graves were trapped on the hillside. Tomorrow, as the first light crept over the arid land, the soldiers would leave those fires and creep carefully towards the hills. If Pharaoh was still there when they arrived, she would be killed for sure. Or worse still, captured. She could not fight that many on her own, even supposing there was no eater with them. She hated to admit it, but her life was in Yulwe's hands now. He squinted up at the starry sky.
"It is time," he said.
They scrambled down the rocky hillside in the darkness, picking their way carefully among the boulders and the odd, scrubby, half-dead bush. Northwards, towards Gurkul. Yulwe moved surprisingly fast, and she was forced to half-run to keep up, eyes fixed on the ground to find her footing among the dry rocks. When they finally reached the base of the hill and she looked up, she saw that Yulwe was leading her toward the left-hand edge of the line, where the fires were most numerous.
"Wait!"
she whispered, grabbing his shoulder. She pointed over to the right-hand side. There were fewer fires there, and it would be easier to slip between them.
"What about that way?"
She could just see Yulwe's teeth smiling white in the starlight.
"Oh, no, Pharaoh Mal'jin. That is where most of the soldiers are, and our other friend."
He was making no attempt to keep his voice down, and it was making her jumpy.
"That is where they expect you to come through if you choose to go north. But they do not expect you. They think you will go south into the desert to die, rather than risk being captured, as indeed you would have done had I not been here."
Yulwe turned and moved off, and she crept after him, keeping low to the ground. As they drew nearer to the fires, she saw that the old man had been right. There were figures sitting around some of them, but they were thinly spread. The old man strode confidently toward four fires on the far left, only one of them manned. He made no effort to stay low. His bangles jingled softly together, his bare feet flapped loud on the dry earth. They were almost close enough to see the features of the three men round the fire. Yulwe would surely be seen at any moment. She hissed at him to grab his attention, sure that she would be heard. Yulwe turned round, looking puzzled in the faint light from the flames.
"What?"
he said. She winced, waiting for the soldiers to leap up, but they chattered on regardless. Yulwe looked over at them.
"They will not see us, nor hear us either, unless you start shouting in their ears. We are safe."
He turned and walked on, giving the soldiers a wide berth. Pharaoh followed, still keeping low and quiet, if only out of habit. As Pharaoh came closer, she began to make out the words of the soldiers' conversation. She slowed, listening. She turned. She started to move towards the fire. Yulwe looked round.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. Pharaoh looked at the three of them, a big, tough-looking veteran, a thin, weaselly type, and an honest-seeming young man who didn't look much like a soldier. Their weapons were lying around, sheathed, wrapped up, unready. She circled them warily, listening.
"They say she's not right in the head,"
the thin one was whispering at the young one, trying to scare him.
"They say she's killed 100 men or more. If you're a good-looking fella, she cuts your fruits off while you're still alive."
He grabbed hold of his crotch, "and eats them in front of you."
"Ah, stop your mouth," said the big one. "She won't be coming near us."
He pointed over to where the fires were sparser, his voice dropping to a whisper.
"She'll be going to him, if she comes this way at all."
"Well, I hope she doesn't," said the young one. "Live and let live, say I."
The thin man frowned.
"And what about all the good men she's killed? And women and children, too? Shouldn't they have been let live?"
Pharaoh's teeth ground together. She'd never killed children that she could think of.
"Well, it's a shame for them, of course. I'm not saying she shouldn't be caught."
The young soldier glanced around nervously.
"Just maybe not by us."
The big man let go a laugh at that, but the thin one didn't look amused.
"You a coward?"
"No," said the young man angrily. "But I got a wife and family depending on me, and I could do without being killed out here, that's all."
He grinned.
"We're expecting another child. Hoping for a son this time."
The big man nodded.
"My son's nearly grown now. They get old so quick."
Talk of children and families and hopes only made the fury in Pharaoh's chest squeeze harder. Why should they be allowed a life when she had nothing? When them and their kind had taken everything from her? She slid the curved knife out of its sheath.
"What are you doing, Pharaoh?"
hissed Yulwe. The young man looked round.
"Did you hear something?"
The big one laughed.
"I think I heard you shit yourself."
The thin one chuckled to himself. The young man smiled, embarrassed. Pharaoh crept right up behind him. She was just a foot or two away, brightly lit by the fire, but none of the soldiers even glanced at her. She raised the knife.
"Pharaoh!"
shouted Yulwe. The young man sprang to his feet. He peered out across the dark plain, squinting, brow furrowed. He looked Pharaoh right in the face, but his eyes were focused far behind her. She could smell his breath. The blade of the knife glittered an inch or less from his stubbly throat.
Now was the time. She could kill him quickly and take the other two as well before the alarm was raised. She knew she could do it. They were unprepared, and she was ready. Now was the time.
But her hand didn't move.
"What's got up your ass?" asked the big soldier. "There's nothing out there."
"Could have sworn I heard something," said the young man, still looking right in her face.
"Wait!"
shouted the thin one, jumping to his feet and pointing.
"There she is, right in front of you!"
Pharaoh froze for an instant, staring at him. Then he and the big man started to laugh. The young soldier looked sheepish, turned around and sat down.
I thought I heard something, that's all.
There's no one out there, said the big man.
Pharaoh began to back slowly away. She felt sick, her mouth full of sour spit, her head thumping. She pushed the knife back into its sheath, turned, and stumbled off, with Yulwe following silently behind. When the light of the fires and the sound of the talking had faded into the distance, she stopped and dropped down on the hard ground. A cold wind blew up across the barren plain. It blew stinging dust in her face, but she hardly noticed. The hate and the fury were gone, for the time being. But they had left a hole, and she had nothing else to fill it with. She felt empty and cold and sick and alone. She hugged herself, rocking slowly back and forth, and closed her eyes. But the darkness held no comfort. Then she felt the old man's hand press onto her shoulder. Now normally she would have twisted away, thrown him off, killed him if she could. But the strength was all gone. She looked up, blinking.
There's nothing left of me.
What am I?
She pressed one hand on her chest, but she barely felt it.
I have nothing inside.
Well, it's strange that you should say that.
Yulwe smiled up at the starry sky.
I was just starting to think there might be something in there worth saving.
Chapter 20 The King's Justice. As soon as he reached the square of marshals, Giselle realized there was something wrong. It was never half this busy for a meeting of the Open Council. He glanced over the knots of finely dressed people as he hurried by, slightly late and out of breath for his long training session. Voices were hushed, faces tense and expectant. He shouldered his way through the crowd to the Lord's Round, glancing suspiciously up at the guards flanking the inlaid doors. They at least seemed the same as ever, their heavy visors giving nothing away. He crossed the antechamber, vivid tapestries flapping slightly in the draught, slipped through the inner doors, and passed into the vast, cool space beyond. His footsteps made tapping echoes in the gilded dome as he hurried down the aisle towards the high table. Jallanhorm was standing beneath one of the tall windows, face splashed with coloured light from the stained glass, frowning at a bench with a metal rail along its base which had been placed to one side of the floor.
"What's going on?"
"Haven't you heard?"
Jallanhorm's voice was whispery with excitement.
"Hoffs, let it be known, there'll be some great matter to discuss."
"What is it? Angland? The Northmen?"
The big man shook his head.
"Don't know, but we'll soon see."
Giselle frowned.
"I don't like surprises."
His eye came to rest on the mysterious bench.
"What's that for?"
At that moment, the great doors were swung open, and a stream of councillors began to flood down the aisle. The usual mixture, Giselle supposed, if a little more purposeful. The younger sons, the paid representatives. He caught his breath. There was a tall man at the front, richly dressed, even in this august company, with a weighty golden chain across his shoulders and a weighty frown across his face.
"Lord Brock himself," whispered Giselle.
"And there's Lord Isha."
Jallanhorm nodded at a sedate old man just behind Brock.
"And Huygen, and Barazin. It's something big, it has to be."
Giselle took a deep breath as four of the Union's most powerful noblemen arranged themselves on the front row. He had never seen the Open Council half so well attended. On the councillor's half-circle of benches, there was barely an empty seat. High above them, the public gallery was an unbroken ring of nervous faces. Now Hoff blustered through the doors and down the aisle, and he was not alone. On his right, a tall man flowed along, slender and proud-looking, with a long, spotless white coat and a shock of white hair. Archlector Salt. On his left walked another man, leaning heavily on a stick, slightly bent in a robe of black and gold with a long grey beard. High Justice Morovia. Giselle could hardly believe his eyes. Three members of the closed council here. Jallanhorm hurried to take his place as the clerks deposited their burdens of ledgers and papers on the polished tabletop. The Lord Chamberlain threw himself down in their midst and immediately called for wine. The head of His Majesty's Inquisition swept into a high chair on one side of him, smiling faintly to himself. High Justice Morovia lowered himself slowly into another, frowning all the while. The volume of the anxious whispering in the hall rose a step. The faces of the great magnates on the front row were grim and suspicious. The announcer took his place before the table, not the usually brightly dressed imbecile, but a dark, bearded man with a barrel chest. He lifted his staff high, then beat it against the tiles, fit to wake the dead.
"I call this meeting of the Open Council of the Union to order," he bellowed.
The hubbub gradually died away.
"There is but one matter for discussion this morning," said the Lord Chamberlain, peering sternly at the house from beneath his heavy brows. "A matter of the King's justice."
There were scattered mutterings.
"A matter concerning the royal license for trade in the city of Westport."
The noise increased. Angry whispers, uncomfortable shufflings of noble asses on their benches, the familiar scratching of quills on the great ledgers. Giselle saw Lord Brock's brows draw together, the corners of Lord Huygen's mouth turned down. They did not seem to like the taste of this. The Lord Chamberlain sniffed and took a swig of wine, waiting for the muttering to die away.
"I am not best qualified to speak on this matter, however."
"No, indeed,"
snapped Lord Isher sharply, shifting in his seat on the front row with a scowl. Hoff fixed the old man with his eye.
"So I call on a man who is. My colleague from the closed council, Archlector Salt."
"The open council recognizes Archlector Salt,"
thundered the announcer, as the head of the Inquisition made his graceful way down the steps of the dais and onto the tiled floor, smiling pleasantly at the angry faces turned towards him.
"My lords,"
he began in a slow, musical voice, ushering his words out into space with smooth movements of his hands.
"For the past 7 years, ever since our glorious victory in the war with Gurkle, an exclusive royal license for trade in the city of Westport has been in the hands of the Honourable Guild of Mercers."
"And a fine job they've done of it," shouted Lord Huygen.
"They won us that war,"
growled Barazin, pounding the bench beside him with a meaty fist.
"A fine job!"
"Fine!"
came the cries. The Archlector nodded as he waited for the noise to fade.
"Indeed they have,"
he said, pacing across the tiles like a dancer, his words scratching their way across the pages of the books.
"I would be the last to deny it. A fine job!"
He spun suddenly around, the tails of his white coat snapping, his face twisted into a brutal snarl.
"A fine job of dodging the king's taxes!"
he screamed. There was a collective gasp.
"A fine job of slighting the king's law!"
Another gasp, louder.
"A fine job of high treason!"
There was a storm of protest, of fists shaken in the air and papers thrown to the floor. Livid faces stared down from the public gallery. Florid ones ranted and bellowed from the benches before the high table. Giselle stared about him, unsure if he could have heard correctly.
"How dare you, Salt?"
Lord Brock roared at the Archlector as he swished back up the steps of the dais, a faint smile clinging to his lips.
"We demand proof," bellowed Lord Huygen. "We demand justice."
"The king's justice,"
came cries from the back.
"You must supply us with proof,"
shouted Isha as the noise began to fade. The Archlector twitched out his white gown, the fine material billowing around him as he swung himself smoothly back into his chair.
"Oh, but that is our intention, Lord Isha."
The heavy bolt of a small side door was flung back with an echoing bang. There was a rustling as lords and proxies twisted round, stood up, squinted over to see what was happening. People in the public gallery peered out over the parapet, leaning dangerously far in their eagerness to see. The hall fell quiet. Giselle swallowed. There was a scraping, tapping, clinking sound beyond the doorway, then a strange and sinister procession emerged from the darkness. Sandan Glockta came first, limping as always and leaning heavily on his cane, but with his head held high and a twisted, toothless grin on his hollow face. Three men shuffled behind him, chained together by their hands and bare feet, clinking and rattling their way towards the high table. Their heads were shaved bare, and they were dressed in brown sackcloth, the clothing of the penitent, confessed traitors. The first of the prisoners was licking his lips, eyes darting here and there, pale with terror. The second, shorter and thicker set, was stumbling, dragging his left leg behind him, hunched over with his mouth hanging open. As Giselle watched, a thin line of pink drool dangled from his lip and spattered on the tiles. The third man, painfully thin and with huge dark rings round his eyes, stared slowly around, blinking, eyes wide, but apparently taking nothing in. Giselle recognized the man behind the three prisoners straight away, the big albino from that night in the street. Giselle rocked his weight from one foot to the other, feeling suddenly cold and uncomfortable. The purpose of the bench was now made clear. The three prisoners slumped down on it. The albino knelt and snapped their manacles shut around the rail along its base. The chamber was entirely silent. Every eye was fixed on the crippled inquisitor and his three prisoners.
"Our investigation began some months ago," said Archlector Salt, immensely smug at having the assembly so completely under his control. "A simple matter of some irregular accounting. I won't bore you with the details."
He smiled at Brock, at Isha, at Barazin.
"I know you all are very busy men. Who could have thought, then, that such a little matter would lead us here? Who would suppose that the roots of treason could run so very deep?"
"Indeed," said the Lord Chamberlain impatiently, looking up from his goblet. "Inquisitor Glockta, the floor is yours."
The announcer struck his staff on the tiles.
"The Open Council of the Union recognizes Sandan Glockta, Inquisitor exempt."
The cripple waited politely for the scratching of the clerk's quills to finish, leaning on his cane in the center of the floor, seemingly unmoved by the importance of the occasion.
"Rise and face the Open Council," he said, turning to the first of his prisoners.
The terrified man sprang up, his chains rattling, licking his pale lips, goggling at the faces of the lords in the front row.
"Your name?" demanded Glockta.
"Salem Ruse."
Giselle felt a catch in his throat.
Salem Ruse. He knew the man. His father had had dealings with him in the past. At one time, he had been a regular visitor to their estate. Giselle studied the terrified, shaven-headed traitor with increasing horror. He cast his mind back to the plump, well-dressed merchant, always ready with a joke. It was him, no doubt. Their eyes met for an instant, and Giselle looked anxiously away. His father had talked with that man in their hallway, had shaken hands with him. Accusations of treason are like illnesses. You can catch them just by being in the same room. His eyes were drawn inevitably back to that unfamiliar, yet horribly familiar face. How dare he be a traitor, the bastard!
"You are a member of the Honourable Guild of Mercers," continued Glockta, putting a sneering accent into the word honourable.
"I was,"
mumbled Ruse.
"What was your role within the guild?"
The shaven-headed mercer stared desperately about him.
"Your role?"
demanded Glockter, his voice taking on a hard edge.
"I conspired to defraud the king,"
cried the merchant, wringing his hands. A wave of shock ran round the hall. Giselle swallowed sour spit. He saw Salt smirking across at High Justice Morovia. The old man's face was stony blank, but his fists were clenched tight on the table before him.
"I committed treason for money. I smuggled, and I bribed, and I lied. We were all at it."
"All at it?" Glockter leered round at the assembly. "And if any of you should doubt it, we have ledgers, and we have documents, and we have numbers. There is a room in the House of Questions stuffed with them. A room full of secrets and guilt and lies." He slowly shook his head. "Sorry reading, I can tell you."
"I had to do it,"
screamed Ruse.
"They made me. I had no choice."
The crippled inquisitor frowned at his audience. "Of course they made you. We realize you were but a single brick in this house of infamy. An attempt was made on your life recently, was it not?"
"They tried to kill me."
"Who tried?"
"It was this man,"
wailed Ruse, voice cracking, pointing a trembling finger at the prisoner next to him, pulling away as far as the chains that linked them would allow.
"It was him! Him!"
The manacles rattled as he waved his arm, spit flying from his mouth. There was another surge of angry voices, louder this time. Giselle watched the head of the middle prisoner sag, and he slumped sideways, but the hulking albino grabbed him and hauled him back upright.
"Wake up, Master Carpi!"
shouted Glockter. The lolling head came slowly up. An unfamiliar face, strangely swollen and badly pocked with acne scars. Giselle noticed with disgust that his four front teeth were missing, just like Glockter's.
"You are from Talens, yes, in Styria?"
The man nodded slowly, stupidly, like someone half asleep.
"You are paid to kill people, yes?"
He nodded again.
"And you were hired to murder 10 of His Majesty's subjects, among them this confessed traitor, Salem Ruse?"
A trickle of blood ran slowly out from the man's nose, and his eyes started to roll back in his head. The albino shook him by the shoulder, and he came round, nodding groggily.
"What became of the other 9?
Silence.
"You killed them, did you not?"
Another nod, a strange clicking sound coming from the prisoner's throat. Glockter frowned slowly around the rapt faces of the council.
"Willem Dan Rob, customs official. Throat cut ear to ear."
He slid a finger across his neck, and a woman in the gallery squealed.
"Solimo Scandi, mercer, stabbed in the back 4 times.
He thrust up 4 fingers, then pressed them to his stomach, as though sickened.
"The bloody list goes on. All murdered, for nothing but a bigger profit. Who hired you?"
"Him," croaked the killer, turning his swollen face to look at the gaunt man with the glassy eyes, slumped on the bench next to him, heedless of his surroundings. Glockter limped over, Kane tapping on the tiles.
"What is your name?"
The prisoner's head snapped up, his eyes focusing on the twisted face of the Inquisitor above him.
"Gottfried Harlech,"
he answered instantly, voice shrill.
"You are a senior member of the Guild of Mercers?"
"Yes,"
he barked, blinking mindlessly up at Glockter.
"One of Magister Colt's deputies, in fact?"
"Yes."
"Have you conspired with other mercers to defraud His Majesty the King? Did you hire an assassin to murder 10 of His Majesty's subjects?"
"Yes, yes."
"Why?"
"We were worried they would tell what they knew. Tell what they knew. Tell..."
Hornlack's empty eyes stared off towards one of the coloured windows. His mouth slowly stopped moving.
"Tell what they knew," prompted the Inquisitor.
"About the treasonous activities of the Guild," the mercer blurted. "About our treasons, about the activities of the Guild, treasonous activities."
Glockter cut in sharply.
"Were you acting alone?"
"No, no."
The Inquisitor wrapped his cane down before him and leaned forward.
"Who gave the orders?" he hissed.
"Magister Cult!" shouted Hornlack instantly. "He gave the orders!"
The audience gasped. Archlector Salt smirked a little wider.
"It was the Magister!"
The quills scratched mercilessly.
"It was Cult! He gave the orders! All the orders! Magister Cult!"
"Thank you, Master Hornlack."
"The Magister, he gave the orders. Magister Cult, Cult, Cult!"
"Enough!" snarled Glockter.
His prisoner fell silent. The room was still. Archlector Salt lifted his arm and pointed toward the three prisoners.
"There is your proof, my lords."
"This is a sham!"
bellowed Lord Brock, leaping to his feet.
"This is an insult!"
Few voices joined him in support, however, and those that did were half-hearted. Lord Huygen was notable for his careful silence, keenly studying the fine leather of his shoes. Barazin had shrunk back into his seat, looking half the size he had been a minute before. Lord Isher was staring off at the wall, fingering his heavy golden chain, looking bored, as though the fate of the Guild of Mercers was of interest to him no longer. Brock appealed to the High Justice himself, motionless in his tall chair at the high table.
"Lord Morovia, I beg of you. You are a reasonable man. Do not allow this travesty."
The hall fell silent, waiting for the old man's reply. He frowned and stroked his long beard. He glanced across at the grinning Archlector. He cleared his throat.
"I feel your pain, Lord Brock, indeed I do, but it seems that this is not a day for reasonable men. The closed council has examined the case and is well satisfied. My hands are tied."
Brock worked his mouth, tasting defeat.
"This is not justice," he shouted, turning round to address his peers. "These men have plainly been tortured."
Archlector Salt's mouth twisted with scorn.
"How would you have us deal with traitors and criminals?" he cried in a piercing voice. "Would you raise a shield, Lord Brock, for the disloyal to hide behind?"
He thumped the table, as if it too might be guilty of high treason.
"I, for one, will not see our great nation handed over to its enemies. Neither enemies without, nor enemies within."
"Down with the mercers!"
came a cry from the public balcony.
"Hard justice for traitors!"
"The king's justice!"
bellowed a fat man near the back. There was a surge of anger and agreement from the floor, and calls for harsh measures and stiff penalties. Brock looked round for his allies on the front row, but found none. He bunched his fists.
"This is no justice!" he shouted, pointing at the three prisoners. "This is no proof!"
"His Majesty disagrees," bellowed Hoff, "and does not require your permission."
He held up a large document.
"The Guild of Mercers is hereby dissolved, their license revoked by royal decree. His Majesty's Commission for Trade and Commerce will, over the coming months, review applications for trade rights with the city of Westport. Until such time as suitable candidates are found, the routes will be managed by capable, loyal hands. The hands of His Majesty's Inquisition."
Archlector Salt humbly inclined his head, oblivious to the furious cries from representatives and public gallery alike.
"Inquisitor Glockter," continued the Lord Chamberlain, "the Open Council thanks you for your diligence and asks that you perform one more service in this matter."
Hoff held out a smaller paper.
This is a warrant for the arrest of Magister Colt, bearing the king's own signature. We would ask that you serve it forthwith.
Glockter bowed stiffly and took the paper from the Lord Chamberlain's outstretched hand.
You, said Hoff, turning his eye on Jallanhorm.
Lieutenant Jallanhorm, my lord,
shouted the big man, stepping smartly forward.
Whatever, snapped Hoff impatiently. Take 20 of the king's own and escort Inquisitor Glockter to the Mercer's Guildhall. Ensure that nothing and no one leaves the building without his orders.
At once, my lord.
Jallanhorm crossed the floor and ran up the aisle toward the exit, holding the hilt of his sword in one hand to stop it knocking against his leg. Glockter limped after him, cane tapping on the steps, the warrant for the arrest of Magister Colt crumpled in his tightly clenched fist. The monstrous albino had pulled the prisoners to their feet, meanwhile, and was leading them, rattling and lolling, off towards the door by which they had entered.
"Lord Chamberlain!"
shouted Brock, with one last effort. Giselle wondered how much money he must have made from the Mercers, how much he had hoped still to make. A very great deal, evidently. But Hoff was unmoved.
"That concludes our business for today, my lords!"
Morovia was on his feet before the Lord Chamberlain had finished speaking, evidently keen to be away. The great ledgers were thumped shut. The fate of the Honourable Guild of Mercers was sealed. Excited babbling filled the air once more, gradually rising in volume, and soon joined by clattering and stamping as the representatives began to rise and leave the room. Archlector Salt remained seated, watching his beaten adversaries file reluctantly off the front row. Giselle met the desperate eyes of Salem Ruse one last time as he was led towards the small door. Then Practical Frost jerked at the chain, and he was lost in the darkness beyond. Outside, the square was even busier than before, the dense throng growing ever more excited as the news of the dissolution of the Guild of Mercers spread to those who had not been within. People stood disbelieving, or hurried here and there, scared, surprised, confused. Giselle saw one man staring at him, staring at anyone, face pale, hands trembling. A Mercer, perhaps, or a man in too deep with the Mercers, deep enough to be ruined along with them. There would be many such men. Giselle felt a sudden tingling. R.D. West was leaning casually against the stones a little further on. They had not met in some time, not since that drunken outburst of hers, and he was surprised how pleased he was to see her. Probably she had been punished long enough, he told himself. Everyone deserved the chance to apologize. He hastened towards her with a broad smile on his lips. Then he noticed who she was with.
"That little bastard," he muttered under his breath.
Lieutenant Brint was chatting freely in his cheap uniform, leaning closer to Ardy than Giselle thought was appropriate, underlining his tedious points with flamboyant gestures of his arms. She was nodding, smiling. Then she tipped her head back and laughed, slapping the lieutenant playfully on the chest. Brint laughed as well. The ugly little shit. They laughed together. For some reason, Giselle felt a sharp pang of fury.
"Giselle! How are you?" shouted Brint,
still giggling. He stepped up close.
"That's Captain Luther," he spat. "And how I am is none of your concern. Don't you have a job to do?"
Brint's mouth hung stupidly open for a moment, then his brows drew into a surly frown.
"Yes, sir,"
he muttered, turning and stalking off. Giselle watched him go with a contempt even more intense than usual.
"Well, that was charming," said Ardy. "Are those the manners you should use before a lady?"
"I really couldn't say. Why, was there one watching?"
He turned to look at her and caught, just for a moment, a self-satisfied smirk. Quite a nasty expression, as though she had enjoyed his outburst. He wondered, for a silly instant, whether she might have arranged the meeting, have placed herself and that idiot where Giselle would see them, hoping to arouse his jealousy. Then she smiled at him and laughed, and Giselle felt his anger fading. She looked very fine, he thought, tanned and vibrant in the sunlight, laughing out loud, not caring who heard. Very fine. Better than ever, in fact. A chance meeting was all. What else could it be? She fixed him with those dark eyes, and his suspicions vanished.
"Did you have to be so hard on him?" she asked.
Giselle fixed his jaw.
"Jumped up, arrogant nobody. He's probably nothing more than some rich man's bastard. No blood, no money, no manners."
"More than me, of all three."
Giselle cursed his big mouth. Rather than dragging an apology from her, he was now in need of giving one himself. He sought desperately for some way out of this self-made trap.
"Oh, but he's an absolute moron," he whined.
"Well," and Giselle was relieved to see one corner of Adi's mouth curl up in a sly smile,
"he is at that. Shall we walk?"
She slipped her hand through his arm before he had the chance to answer and started to lead him off towards the Kingsway. Giselle allowed himself to be guided between the frightened, the angry, the excited people.
"So is it true?" she asked.
"Is what true?"
"That the Mercers are finished."
"So it seems. Your old friend Sandan Glockter was in the thick of it. He gave quite the performance for a cripple."
Adi looked down at the floor.
"You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him, crippled or no."
"No."
Giselle's mind went back to Salem Rue's terrified eyes, staring desperately at him as he vanished into the darkness of the archway.
"No, you wouldn't."
A silence descended on them as they strolled down the avenue, but it was a comfortable one. He liked walking with her. It no longer seemed important whether anyone apologized. Perhaps she had been right about the fencing anyway, just a little. Adi seemed to read his thoughts.
"How's the sword play going?" she asked.
"Not bad. How's the drinking going?"
She raised a dark eyebrow.
"Excellent well. If only there was a contest for that every year, I'd soon come to the attention of the public."
Giselle laughed, looking down at her as she walked beside him, and she smiled back.
"So clever, so sharp, so fearless, so damn fine-looking."
Giselle wondered if there had ever been a woman quite like her.
"If only she had the right blood," he thought to himself, "and some money. A lot of money."
Chapter 21. Means of Escape.
"Open the door in the name of His Majesty!"
thundered Lieutenant Jallanhorm for the third time, hammering at the wood with his meaty fist.
The great oaf. Why do big men tend to have such little brains? Perhaps they get by on brawn too often, and their minds dry up like plums in the sun.
The Mercer's Guildhall was an impressive building in a busy square not far from the Agriant. A substantial crowd of onlookers had already gathered around Glockter and his armed escort, curious, fearful, fascinated, growing all the time.
They can smell blood, it seems.
Glockter's leg was throbbing from the effort of hurrying down here, but he doubted that the Mercers would be taken entirely by surprise. He glanced round impatiently at the armoured guardsmen, at the masked practicals, at the hard eyes of Frost, at the young officer beating on the door.
"Open the—"
"Enough of this foolishness." "I think they heard you, Lieutenant," said Glockter crisply, "but are choosing not to answer. Would you be so kind as to break the door down?"
"What?"
Jallanhorm gawped at him, and then at the heavy double doors firmly secured.
"How will I—"
Practical Frost hurtled past. There was a deafening crack and a tearing of wood as he crashed into one of the doors with his burly shoulder, tearing it off its hinges and sending it crashing onto the floor of the room beyond.
"Like so,"
muttered Glockter as he stepped through the archway, the splinters still settling. Jallanhorm followed him, looking dazed, a dozen armored soldiers clattering behind. An outraged clerk blocked the corridor beyond.
"You can't just—"
he cried as Frost flung him out of the way and his face crunched into the wall.
"Arrest that man!"
shouted Glockter, waving his cane at the dumbstruck clerk. One of the soldiers grabbed him roughly with gauntleted